Well, the typical expression is when the cat's away, the mice will play. And you see in 1 Samuel 30, something like that. David and his men are up north. They presumably have gone up to help the Philistines conquer the Israelites, which is a bizarre thing even to think about, much less say. When they get back, they find that the camp where they've been staying in Ziklag has been raided. The city has been sacked, burned to the ground. All the inhabitants have been carried away into captivity, presumably if they're still alive, to be sold as slaves, or else they took them somewhere else to kill them. Also, the spoils of war have been taken at the same time, and so they come back to absolutely nothing. So after about this 3 or so day trip, they get back, and that's the situation. David is very distressed. Not only does he lose everything he has, but he also has the men who he's been with who now have turned against him. David, we're told in the last part of verse 6, strengthened himself in the Lord his God. It may be that the only friend David had in this world besides his family at this moment were these words implying his relationship with God. So in verse 7, David immediately goes to Abiathar the priest and asks him to bring the ephod to him, and he brings the ephod to David. At this point in verse 8, it tells us that David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I pursue this troop? Shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them?" You know how it is when you're going through a panic, you're in a very dangerous situation, loved ones' lives are at stake, you're liable to say several sentences before you get through. You want to know everything at once. And so you get the impression, shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them? The answer comes back, pursue, for you shall surely overtake them and without cover, without fail, recover all. The word inquired here means to ask or consult. It's a typical word you would expect when you see someone in the Old Covenant asking someone, anyone, for information. Here, David, of course, asking God for help. The ephod, we've seen that before in Exodus chapter 28. And concerning the answers that you get from this ephod, two things need to be emphasized. First of all, this is a way of getting direct communication from God. You're hearing right through that priest what God himself has to say about this particular situation. It doesn't get any better than that. Saul had access to this same thing and ignored it because he went by what he thought he should do, and he used his own judgment. As in 1 Samuel 14, put that away. I'm just going to go out and do it. David never just went out and did it. He always inquired of the Lord, especially when there was trouble there. And I'm reminded of John 16, 13, when the Spirit came upon the apostles. What did he do for them? John 16, 13. Remember? My mind is a total blank, as usual. The Spirit came upon them, and what did he do? He guided them into all truth. Why was that necessary? Because if they didn't go by what God guided them in, they'd end up like Saul. We don't want that, do we? Anybody who reads this 1 Samuel realizes we don't want to end up like Saul. That was a one-man disaster. And then in Acts 8, you remember the eunuch is asked by Philip, "Do you understand what you're reading?" And what was his response? "Unless someone guide me." So here's the Spirit who guides the apostles. They impart gifts to others who are then able to speak as God guides them. That guidance provides the answer for the eunuch. He's able to know. And we don't have any spiritual gifts. What do we do for guidance? Any ideas? Any suggestions? Oh, how novel. Almost nobody says that today. But long before these spiritual gifts were spoken of, if you'll read Psalm 119, read how often it talks about this guidance of God by His Word. It'll use in the Septuagint the same word that's used in those New Testament passages, John 16 and Acts 8, for that guidance even. So he's talking about guiding us through His Word. Whether that word came directly from God or intermediately through someone who had received that, or if it came through the writings of someone who had received it. Like Paul said, "When I received this by revelation," Ephesians 3, "I wrote it down." Now you can Read these words that I've written, and you'll have understanding that equals mine. You just get it in a different channel. I got it directly from God. You get it indirectly through the word He gave me to write for you. So that's what we need to focus on, first of all. Then second, the answer God gives. This is a fascination of mine. The question is, shall I pursue this troop? Shall I overtake them? Now, at first glance, you would expect God to say, yes. But that's more of a complexity in the question than it is just a yes or no. You get the impression from the Urim and the Thummim and the Ephod that what's going on is you'd ask a yes or no question and God would answer, yes, do this. No, don't do that. Now, if there is a situation where God is answering that question and you're relating what God said yes to, you can say more than just a yes or no, won't you? And I think that's probably what's going on here in verse 8 when it says, He answered him, pursue, for you shall surely overtake them and without fault recover all. What does that imply? It may mean they said, Lord, shall we pursue them? And if we do, will we get them back? What's the situation here? And God says, yes. And they say, God said that if we pursue them, we'll get them back. Is that correct? Yes. All he had to do is say yes in order to get that. So you can see how easy that would be for God to communicate in that way. Now, in verse 9, so David went, he and the 600 men who were with him, and came to the brook Besor, where those stayed who were left behind. So when it says David went, we look at a further extension of this same idea we've been talking about. Here's a person who needs God's guidance, right? So he asks of God, and God gives the answer. Today, we need guidance. We go to the Scriptures. We pray about it. We look in the Word, and we find our answer. Now, what is the next component when God gives that answer? What is the next line on our part? We accept what He said. We accept what He said. It's not one of those things where He said, yeah, I thought about that, but Lord, that's not what I want to do. Tell me something else. That's what Saul basically did. David is no Saul. I'm not going to keep talking about Saul, but I just find it interesting. At this point, he's still alive. I have just another few moments to talk about Saul. But it tells us, David went. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things I command you? When I tell you to do it, why don't you do it? They go to the brook Besor. Let me see if I can get some visuals. I know there is a key to doing this. There you go. If you guess, just try long enough. I don't think the brook Besor is on here, but it will be down somewhere close to where Ziklag is. And we don't know where Ziklag is either, so I hope that's very helpful to you. But it's in this southern area. Now, as you look at this verse, David went and the 600 who were with him. And they came to this brook, about 12 or so, because we don't know exactly where Ziklag is, approximately 12 or so miles from Ziklag. They set out immediately. Their first goal in mind is to rescue their loved ones, then secondarily punish those who have done this, to recover their possessions. Yes, that's part of it. But mainly, this mission is from God. Their loved ones are in danger and they're ready to go. So when we see a loved one in danger, it's just natural for us to respond. When we see a loved one in spiritual danger, it's even more natural to respond. And this illustrates that principle. So, we have verse 10 saying this, David pursued, he and 400 men, for 200 stayed behind, who were so weary that they could not cross the brook Besor. So, you can imagine, after a trip from Aphek up in the north, you can see Aphek up there, at least close, to where David is in Ziklag, about a 3-day journey, and they get back, and they're ready to rest. They're ready to say hi to the family, and boy, am I bushed. This was tiring. This was emotionally exhausting in every way. We're just exhausted. And you see, there's smoke going up, and the city's burned to the ground, and your loved ones are gone. And it's the worst news you could possibly get. So they're already exhausted. Now they're making this other, who knows, dozen or 20 miles from where they lived in Ziklag, and they end up being so exhausted that 200 of them, after they cross, cannot go any further. They said, we just can't make any further. When they came this distance from this upper region to go home, they didn't come in their Cadillacs and They didn't come in their jets, and they didn't come by boat. It'd be kind of hard and sand to do that. But they came walking, most likely. And that just adds to the fatigue. Now, they're here. They've gone as far as they can go. They haven't had food. They don't take time to eat before they go, apparently. So that one of the things we learn from this is God can say, yes, I want you to go, and I want you to do this. But it doesn't mean you won't have trials facing you on the way. Do you think of any New Testament character who went and did precisely what God wanted him to do, but he met a few trials along the way? Anybody come to mind? Who? Paul. Look at Paul. 2 Corinthians 11 is all you need to see, right? So, yes, there are obstacles along the way. Furthermore, 200 stay behind. How many does that leave David? 400 men. Now, I feel quite certain that the Amalekites number more than 400. I believe we can say that because 400 young men escape on camels before David can capture those. If that's how many escaped, I guarantee they had more than that to start with. So their number is bigger than David's. So he's now going to lose 200 out of his 600. But we don't really worry so much about size if God is the one guiding this army. Why is that? What have we seen so far that shows us that number not only doesn't matter, but sometimes gets in the way? What do you think of? Gideon. David has 100 more than Gideon did. Gideon had 300. David has 400. Not counting the 200 that stayed behind. It tells us they were weary, which means exhausted, in an extreme state of physical fatigue and tiredness, too faint to go on. And it seems like one obstacle after another is coming upon these people when in verse 11, a break comes. They found an Egyptian in the field and brought him to David, and they gave him bread, and he ate, and they let him drink water. Finding a guide is a great blessing. This, in the providence of God, lets them know where they need to go. They bless him, he blesses them. This is one hand washing the other. You notice how that works. It's hard for one hand to wash itself, but one hand washes the other. Here, they can help him save his life, give him food, give him drink. He can give them information that can let them locate these people and find their loved ones. They found him in the field. This illustrates how difficult it is to travel in a desert area. Desert doesn't always mean simply sand and cactuses, or cacti, I guess you would call them. But it means a place that there are no street markers. Nobody lives there. It is a desert is a deserted or deserted place. And in a deserted or deserted place, you don't see paths, well-worn paths. You don't see proper trails to take. You don't see wagon ruts, any of these things. And so you don't know, especially the more barren it becomes in the southern part of Judea, it becomes difficult to know if you're going the same direction you were going a while ago. And you may be going around in circles, and people have done things like this and run out of water and perished. So it's difficult and it's hazardous. You don't see a single street sign to guide you. It didn't say this way to the Amalekite camp. What you do find, though, is someone like this Egyptian who knows exactly which direction to go, because he's been left behind by them some few days before. So verse 12 says, they gave him a piece of a cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. So when he had eaten, his strength came back, and he had eaten, for he had eaten no bread nor drunk water for 3 days and three nights. It's amazing what a little nourishment can do. Now, we've seen a cake of figs as a part of the dietary blessings that Abigail brought when David's men were on the march to kill everybody in that place. 3 days and three nights indicates that at least this amount of time had occurred since the sacking of Ziklag. So that kind of puts a time period on this. And then verse 13, David said to him, "To whom do you belong? And where are you from?" And he said, "I'm a young man from Egypt, servant of an Amalekite. And my master left me behind because 3 days ago I fell sick." Okay. To say this man is a servant can mean a hired servant, such as a domestic, or it can mean a slave. Here it's a slave, obviously. He's not just an employee, but someone who's owned by this Amalekite master. And he got sick. Now, what do you do when you have a slave and they have absolutely no rights at all Well, they have a retirement plan for them and a health plan. If they're sick, leave them there to die. And that's what they did. Many folks in the ancient world viewed a slave as a person who not only had no rights, but they're just like a tool, like a grubbing hole, or an adze, or a saw, or something. If it breaks, throw it away and get you another one. And eventually, as a slave got older, that's what would happen to most of them. They didn't have a retirement plan. They had no health plan. They had to do whatever the master said. And if they didn't stay healthy, they got the push out the door. So this one illustrates something that was going on around the world at this time. I think we may have alluded to this. Amos 1 illustrates how the slave trade was very, very brisk at this time. It was going on around the world. So David and his men debrief this man. They want to know, all right, we want the details. Were you at this place? Do you know where to find these people? Give us the information you know. So he starts talking to them. 3 days ago I fell sick. Verse 14, we made an invasion of the southern area of the Kerethites and the territory which belongs to Judah, and of the southern area of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire. When he said that he was an Amalekite in verse 13, when he says in 14, we made this raid, we burned Ziklag with fire, we've been attacking some of these areas of Judah, that says quite a bit. The Kerethites are always mentioned in connection with the Pelethites. The Kerethites and the Pelethites are words that describe the origin of the Philistines. And it's pretty obvious that's the case. 2 Samuel 8, verse 18. I believe this is the correct verse. When David, in his administration, called for certain men to help him, he chose some of these very valiant warriors to be his aides. 2 Samuel 8, 18. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, who was over both the Kerethites and the Pelethites, David's sons were chief ministers. Later on, you'll see in chapter 15, when David is fleeing the city of Jerusalem because of his son Absalom, we're told in verse 18, all his servants passed before him, and all the Kerethites, all the Pelethites, and all the Gittites, 600 men who had followed him from Gath. Gath, one of the five Pentapolis cities of the Philistine area. They passed before the king. Zephaniah 2, I'll just indulge in one more reference, we'll go on. But Zephaniah chapter 2, 827. Zephaniah 2, verse 4. Listen to what he says. For Gaza shall be forsaken, and Ashkelon desolate. They shall drive out Ashdod at noonday, and Ekron shall be uprooted. Here, at the very time when you least expect it, the noonday, they're driven out, and not an attack of surprise at all. During the heat, soldiers rest most of the time. Here, at the noonday, Ekron shall be uprooted. Woe to the inhabitants of the seacoast, the nation of the Kerethites. The word of the Lord is against you, O Canaan, land of the Philistines. I will destroy you, so there shall be no inhabitant. The seacoast shall be pastures. He's still talking about all this area of the Philistines. With shelters for shepherds and folds for flocks. The coast shall be for the remnant of the house of Judah. They shall feed their flocks there in the houses of Ashkelon. They shall lie down at evening, for the Lord their God will intervene for them and return their captives. There's a captivity and a return involved. So that was a judgment he pronounces upon them. Ezekiel 25 does the same thing. Now, he's saying here then, we went in an invasion to the southern area of the Kerethites. If David has been working for Achish, a Philistine, and he's been raiding some of these areas where the Amalekites live, which is obviously true, they may blame not just David, but the Philistines for having done this. And so you see, this war is kind of spreading as people say, I'm going to get you back for what you've done to me. So in verse 15, David said to him, can you take me down to this troop? So he said, swear to me by God that you will neither kill me nor deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will take you down to this troop. So the deal is, the slave says, I'll tell you whatever you want to know. I'll take you to these people if you'll promise don't give me back to my master. Now, that's about the farthest thing from David's mind, isn't it? Why is that? There's not going to be a master. He's going to die. Yes, that's the last thing David wants to do. He has other plans. So verse 16. When he had brought him down, there they were spread out over the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil which they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. So it was party time. When the cat's away, the mice play. This time the cat was near and they weren't aware of it. So you think about their circumstance at this point. They think they are safely removed from David and his men. In fact, where do they think David and his men are at this time they've made this attack? They think they're up north fighting with the Philistines against Israel. Everybody knew about this rift between David and Saul. That's where David is. They don't know he's come back early. They don't know he's found that slave that was left for dead and that slave has led them to their camp. They don't know any of this. So it's party time. When it's party time, you gorge. You drink, if you're immoral people like this. And so here, they've gorged themselves with food and drink. How effective are you at fighting when you're gorged? You're sitting ducks. You're sitting Amalekites. So, in this, I don't know if it's a hangover state or just a self-indulgent state, they're sitting ducks either way. This reminds me of some statements made about the judgment of God. Look at Matthew 24. He's giving a parallel in this passage to what happened in the days of Noah. He's turned from the destruction of Jerusalem, I believe, at this point, to discuss what's going to happen at the end of the age. He says, but of that day and hour, this is Matthew 24:36, of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. You know what it's going to be like? He says, verse 37, but as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. What's the point of the comparison? How wasn't the days of Noah? Verse 38, for as in the days before the flood they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. You see, they're eating, they're drinking, they're marrying, they're giving in marriage, and he purposely, I believe, shies away from all the atrocities these people were guilty of so that their thoughts were only evil continually to talk about just the normal things they like to engage in. Recreation, family time, all these things that are innocent in themselves, but they totally forget God. They totally forget the judgment. They just live for themselves, just like America and most nations around the world is doing now. The last thing in our minds as Americans or French or German, whatever, is to think, well, God's judgment, His sending of His Son, could be very near. And so we're eating and we're drinking, we're having a good time as a people, and we're not prepared for the judgment God can send. That's their situation. It's a situation here with Amalek. So, in verse 17, David attacked them from twilight until the evening of the next day. Not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who rode on camels and fled. Now, the word twilight is a fascinating word. It has a double usage, both in English and in the ancient world. It can be that time just before it gets real dark, it started to turn dark. Or it can be that time in the morning when it's not so dark, but it started to turn light. It can be an a.m. or a p.m. situation. And so you have here a case where if this is dawn, then David has slept the night through and he's waited till the next morning, and just as it's starting to turn daylight in that twilight, he goes out when these men least expect it. That'd be an attack until about 6 p.m. That's when their evening would come. Otherwise, it would be he's waited till it got just a little bit dark and then he makes his attack then. Either way, they're not expecting it at either of those times. Is your hand up?
Yeah, we still do that today.
And attacks?
Yeah. Before morning nautical twilight is the time.
Say that again.
Before morning nautical twilight is an area in which the sun is so many degrees below the horizon and you are mustering up, and many times we make that attack at that point in time.
Yeah.
Because you can get onto the objective, and then by the time you're on the objective, now you have light enough, and usually sentries are tired by that time.
Mm-hmm. Which was supposed to be D-Day, right? When D-Day was supposed to start some of those.
Yeah.
Very, very excellent. So, Dave?
Pull back a little bit to verse 15 and find it interesting that
Oh, I meant to say it. Thank you for bringing that out. Go ahead.
So just tell us who David, wanting you to know who David was, not Philistine, and knew who David believed in versus just any other God.
Yes. And do you remember someone else who had used the name of God we talked about last week? Remember Achish? Swore to him by God? And so, yeah, very good. I appreciate you bringing that out. I totally, totally forgot to do so. Yes, sir?
Well, this is an aside, but I think verse 16 is the only place in the Bible where you have men and women dancing together. And, of course, there's bad, evil men. The women are forced.
Excellent. Very good point. Very good point. Anybody else? I always get my bucket filled when I come. Okay. David attacks them from twilight until the evening of the next day. Now, whichever time this begins, I don't know. But not a man of them escaped except these 400. The 400, the same number as David's fighting men, escaped. And then they're young men. And you remember in verse 13, it's a young man who has told him where to go to get these people to start with. In verse 18, so David recovered all that the Amalekites had carried away, which was the implication God had given when he told them to go. And David rescued his two wives. David attacked, verse 17. David recovered, verse 18. David rescued, again, verse 18. David recovered all, verse 19. David took all the flocks, verse 20. This is David's spoil, verse 20. And yet, what does verse 23 say? The Lord, not David, did this. The Lord has given us. So keep that in mind as we go through this. David was merely God's agent. He's approved agent to carry out this attack, and he did what God said. The Lord is one who gave the victory. Now, contrast Saul, his disobedient neglect is what led to this need to start with. We've made the point already, I won't even say it again, that if we don't take care of problems now, they'll face us again later. So I didn't even say that. David takes care of present duties. These Amalekites are never going to raid again. They're gone. They'll never harm anyone again. David prayed as if all of it depended on God. It was all upon God's information. It was on God's permission to go. It was on what do you want us to do when we're there. It was all up to God. But he fought as if it were totally up to him. That's the tension you see anytime we pray. We don't answer our own prayers, but we act as though it's totally up to us, and we depend upon God as though it's totally up to him. And both of those to go together like a hand and a glove. Both are necessary. God answers, but he expects us to do our part. Like the two little girls are running late from school. Let's pray because we're going to be late. The other says, well, let's run while we pray. The proper attitude that you see here. Okay, any comments before we go on? Okay, verse 19. It tells us nothing of theirs was lacking. Either small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything which they had taken from them, David recovered all. Now that's what God had promised, verse 8. In Luke 15, we usually pursue lost things. If you have a sheep that's missing, you go look for that sheep. Though you have 99 there, you don't say, I have the 99. Well, let him go. That's what he wants. You have a coin that's missing, you have nine others, but you look for the one that's lost. You have a son that's lost, you look for that son that's lost. You don't say, well, I have another one, so I'm in good shape. You go looking for the one that's lost. That's what we do with lost things. In 2 Timothy 2, when we talk about lost souls, this is one of the feature departments of the New Testament. Our mind is to be set in this realm. 2 Timothy 2, he's talking about a servant of the Lord. And he's given some qualifications in verse 23. Not quarrel, be gentle, able to teach, patient. And then he says, in humility, correcting those who are in opposition. If God perhaps will grant them repentance. How does God grant a person repentance? I thought that's something we have to do. Time, teaching, specifics, opportunity. Going after them. So that they may know the truth. And and that they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will. Here are people who are far worse than David and his men's family, who have been captured by Amalekites. That's bad. These people have been captured by Satan. It's our goal to do what David and his men did, to go and in humility and in adherence strictly to God's word, bring those back to where they need to be. Now, in verse 20, then David took all the flocks and herds they had driven before those other livestock and said, this is David's spoil. This is David's spoil. You remember when Gideon was rewarded for what he did with his 300, they bought all this gold and laid before him. David's motive, of course, is to do what he can to help those in Judea not be bitter against him in any way. And so we'll see that he will bring a lot of this spoil that he has to those brothers of his in Judea. Needless to say, David goes from zero to hero in one day. And in verse 21, David came to the 200 men who had been so weary that they could not follow David, whom they also had made to stay at the brook Besor. So they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near the people, he greeted them. So the 200 have gone as far as they could go. They've done all that they could do. And others went farther and did more. So some went this far, they had to stop. They couldn't go farther. Others went farther. Does that remind you of any principle in the New Testament? Workers in the vineyard. Anything else? Sorry? Instead, yeah, have the attitude of if you go in my go to instead. Imagine the shocked look on the centurion. He says, carry this a mile, I'll take it too. Anything else?
The laborers who come at the 13th hour.
Yeah, they come when they have 1 hour to work. They haven't borne the heat of the day and they're paid like all the others. Yeah, very parallel to this. Also, what else? Parable of the talents. Here you have one with five, one with two, and one just has one. He's worth nothing, isn't he? He's worthless. He's like me. And yet, what does he say? The problem wasn't that he didn't have more talents. What was his problem? He didn't use what he had. And do you notice when the master praises the one who had five and gained five more, and the one with two and he gained two more, he gave the same language of praise to the one would start out with two that he did with the one with the five.
I mean, they understand also that when it talks about exhausted, if their families have been taken and they are so tired that they cannot go after their families,
you know,
there's not a, you know, they're just faking it.
There's no way.
They will be combat ineffective and they will be casualties themselves, and they're more of a problem taking them on further than it would be to just leave them there. The other part of this is they do function as a rear guard.
Exactly.
I mean, he doesn't know Philistines changed their mind, they're going to come back, you know, come after them, who knows. But there's 200 men there, they're watching your flying. So.
And by keeping the baggage, they make the journey lighter. Absolutely. For the others who go. They've done what they can. Dave?
They also don't risk someone coming and taking their stuff because they left it to a...
They're guarding the stuff, yes. Several good things that you can see in them. So, we understand with the talents that you give the same praise to the one talent man that you do to the others. If what? If he's willing to do the best he can with what he has. Nobody's telling him you have to act like you're a two-talent man or a five-talent man. Just do the best you can with what you have. That's what the principle is. Well, in verse 22, then all the wicked and worthless men of those who went with David answered and said, because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except for every man's wife and children, that they may lead them away and depart. Here, you get your wives back, you get your children back, and your goods. That's it. Well, these are wicked and worthless. They're greedy men even among the good guys. That's kind of sad. The expression wicked is, according to the proper channels. The word that's used in Acts 24, verse 5, when the famous orator Tertullus comes to Caesarea, and he's going to tell everybody how bad Paul is. So he says in verse 5, he's a spokesman for the Jews. We have found this man a plague. That word plague is your word right here. So these men were like what Paul was said to be, a plague, a sickness. The second word, worthless, in verse 22, is a degenerate, a vicious, worthless person. Interestingly, in chapter 1, verse 16, this is what Eli thought Hannah was when she was moving her lips, but no words were coming out during her prayer. He thought she was this level, which is about as bad as you can get. It's used in 2 Timothy 3:13, evil men and imposters will grow worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. So they get family and possessions, but they don't get their spoils. They don't consider that they've done the best they could. They're demanding more of these men than God had. They've done the service we've already talked about. And they're focusing on the shortcomings of these people rather than upon their own spiritual needs. They're not spiritual giants in any of this. Yes?
Interesting of God's description of people who are a bit of a respecter of persons.
Yes. Oh, yes. Steve.
Kind of back to these descriptions, it is kind of interesting because it seems to reveal that, in contrast, it didn't just say, well, there were some with David that said we shouldn't give this back to this spoil back to the good men. But the descriptions used in it seem like there's some real resentment in these men's heart.
It does. We did the work. Why should they get any of the spoils? Yeah. And verse 23. David said, my brethren, you shall not do so with what the Lord has given us, who has preserved us and delivered into our hand the troop that came against us. David, the true leader here, doesn't say, well, the people said, who said that? That's Saul. This is a true leader. Isn't it refreshing? Finally. So, he's not influenced by the people. David is going to do what's right, not what's popular. He says, we're going to follow God. God is the one who's given this. So he gives credit where credit's due. It's not, look at me, let's build a statue for me. Let's talk about me. In verse 24, for who will heed you in this matter? But as his part is who goes down to the battle, so shall his part be who stays by the supplies that they shall share alike. So they're going to get their spoils. But it's only because of the intercession of David. The principles equal shares. Some of you, if you've studied the Punic Wars a couple hundred years before Christ, Scipio Africanus, the famous Roman general, had in his army, he was a brilliant, brilliant strategist. He required the spoils that they got after defeating Hannibal to be distributed equally to everybody in his army. Put it like this. Both the reserve, those who guarded the tents, the sick, those detached on any special service, all shared and shared alike. He must have been reading 1 Samuel 30. Because that's exactly what he says God wanted David to do on this occasion. The blessings come. We'll have to hurry with this and we'll be... I'll take any comments as long as you want to make them, but I'll be through. The blessings come when each member does its part. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 12. The eye cannot say to the foot. The head cannot say to the hand. And all this. Every part is necessary. We need each other. Judges 7:21. Each man stood in his place. That's precisely what you have here. Supporting the preaching is as necessary as the preaching. Matthew 10. Who receives you receives me. He who receives a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. 42 of Matthew 10. Whoever gives one of these little ones only a cup of cold water in the name of a disciple, he'll not lose his reward. You may not have done what that person did, but if you supported that, if you encouraged that, if you did your part to help him. Same way with supporting elders. 1 Thessalonians 5. We urge you, brethren, recognize those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you and to esteem them very highly in love for their work's sake, be at peace among yourselves. The least you can do is be at peace among one another to make their burden lighter, but also to esteem them and work with them and not against them. Praying for fellow Christians is as necessary for anything else anybody does. 1 Thessalonians 5:17, pray without ceasing. Paul encouraged brethren repeatedly to pray for him. Any comments before we have to close? Gray.
I planted Paul's water. God gave him.
Look at that. 1 Corinthians 3.
Absolutely. It's something we all do together. And
there's no one person. It's all working together.
Excellent. It has nothing to do with work. It has everything to do with role. And we can do absolutely what we need to do within the roles that we have. And every role is important.
I'll find another way. Any others? Stay.
You know, it's kind of interesting, too. This is the second time there was a potential mutiny on David's hand, and he did not lash out at either time. The first time we saw that they were even, they cannot stop him, not kill him. But he didn't lash back and say, well, bring him to bed or get confrontational with him. And this second time, too, again, he did not get confrontational with him, and then he followed his brother.
Very good. Very good.